How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? What's the real truth about Citizen Kane?
It'll probably turn out to be a very simple thing.
Hello, everybody. We hope you're doing well. I'm Parker.
And hello, Parker. Hello, Parker. Hello. Who am I?
Max Bennion.
Thank you for remembering, Parker. We've got a great show for our listeners today. A big show today. Oh, man.
We'll try it again. That's my bad.
I had to scroll over because I couldn't remember if there was another show description.
Oh, I see.
Because the document's half my screen right now.
I see.
But I fixed it.
Oh, good.
And I'm ready.
All right.
And also, I'm going to toss my phone over there.
Marvelous.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. We hope you're doing well. I'm Parker.
And hello, Parker. Hello, Parker. Hello. Who am I?
Max Bennion.
Thank you for remembering, Parker. We've got a great show for our listeners today. A big show today. A Kane-sized show, which reminds me, what's the name of our podcast?
It's Better Than Citizen Kane, the highly subjective show where we look at a movie and ask that titular question. Because when every movie ever made is a reasonable contender for the title of greatest film of all time, you have to wonder, better than Citizen Kane?
So grab your shades, finally turn off the lights on your dad's storefront, and get ready to rock and roll as we discuss Tom Hanks' directorial debut, his underrated 1996 film, Twitter fave, That Thing You Do. Now, Parker, correct me if I'm wrong, but this film is your biggest fan, isn't it?
That's exactly right, yes. This film is my biggest fan. Has been
that's
for
great.
A very long time. We're very close.
Aw. Obviously, that's a play off of, You're My Biggest Fan, said in this movie by Guy Patterson to Del Paxton.
Indeed.
Which is to say, Parker, you're a big fan of this movie.
I am a big fan of this movie.
How long have you been a big fan of this movie?
Okay, so interesting backstory with this. All growing up, my parents had a mixtape that they would play in the car. And on that mixtape was a lot of different things. A lot of like Queen and Beatles and Beach Boys and Regina Spektor. And in amongst all of this was the entire soundtrack for That Thing You Do. So I grew up listening to all of the songs in this movie in that context and being told, oh, it's from a movie. But like I knew all these songs as pop and rock songs. Like that was it. And then when Netflix first started getting going, my parents were like, oh, hey, we can rent the physical disc of That Thing You Do and have it shipped in the mail. And they had seen it back in college and really enjoyed it, which is why they had the soundtrack. But we never watched it as a family. And so probably like 12 or 13, we watched this for the first time. And it's been just an absolute family staple ever since. It's one of those movies we all just get together and we watch and we love and we quote constantly. And it's kind of like a de facto text for my family's sense of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that.
So it goes deep. What about you, Max? What runs deep. What is your history with
That Thing You Do? Well, my parents also had seen it at some point and really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And when I was around 12 or 13, we watched it. And I remember watching it. I remember liking it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I added That Thing You Do, the song, to a playlist when I was in eighth grade. And that has remained on a playlist or more or like a few ever since. So,
nice.
I didn't like immediately get attached to it as much, but I was like, oh, this is like a fun movie that I watched with my parents and I really like the music and I'm going to listen to the song. And so I would listen to the song.
It's a good
and
song.
That's pretty much it. And then of course, obviously I alluded to it in the intro, but every once in a while, the clip of them hearing their song on the radio for the first time makes the rounds on Twitter.
Yep.
And everyone goes, this is the best sequence of joy in a film ever. Which is high praise
for
a movie directed by Tom Hanks in the 90s that, for the most part, people remember, but it isn't, like, talked about as...
Sure.
Is it? I don't know.
I mean, it's kind of... It's very cult classic-y. Like, the people who know, and they kind of try to spread the good word, but it's not... widely talked about, like to the point that was it Cinefix or Collider? Some like very large like film YouTube channel did a series about like the best movie you've never heard of, and they had this in the rotation where they're like, hey, this movie's incredible, nobody talks about it. So I think it's kind of a little underground still.
Well, and when who's the Fountains of Wayne lead singer who wrote the music for this?
Oh, shoot. It's Andy Schlesinger, I think.
I think so.
I'm, we should probably double check that,
but let's move forward with that.
Yeah.
When he passed away,
mm-hmm.
I remember there was this outpouring of love for his songs, not only from his band, but especially That Thing You Do. Mm-hmm. Because he so expertly recreated songs from this era, from the 60s.
Yeah, Adam Schlesinger.
Okay, great.
And I'm probably mispronouncing that, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Hey. But yeah, so I mean, I feel like that's another part of this film's kind of legacy is kind of the boost, mm-hmm. not a boost, but like when he like passed away,
yeah.
I feel like there was another outpouring of love. It feels like it's in people's hearts, but it's just not talked about.
Totally.
A lot. So
yeah, I'd agree. With that.
That's where I'm at with it. But what do you know about its production, Parker? Do you?
Yeah. So I have some research, not as much as I would have liked, because dear listeners, I was moving this weekend and I was a little busy.
This is Parker's birthday pick, and he has been so busy moving apartments.
Yeah. But thank goodness it's all locked up here. It's just I would have liked to have done a bit more research, but I have lots of things to talk about.
Sure. Also, real quick, can we get a happy birthday for Parker Rollins? Happy birthday.
Shucks, guys. Thanks. So
everyone said it in unison.
They did, yeah. Across the world. Amazing.
You heard it just now?
In the future. It echoed through time.
Wow. All right, what's the research?
Okay, so this film is written and directed by Tom Hanks. Just a little known dude.
His only writer director credit, but he has directed since. There's one movie. Mm-hmm.
He directed.
Which is not as cult classically beloved.
No. Which I don't even know the name of off the top of my head, but I do know that it exists, yes. But this is his one like do it writer both, director. Right? So it was interesting. He started writing, like, he had the idea kicking around in his brain for ages, because he talks about how he was either 8 or 9 when the Beatles played on the Ed Sullivan Show. And that was just, like, it was pretty soon after the Kennedy assassination, I believe, 64?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so he was talking about how, like, in the midst of all of that, like, it was such, like, a joyful sound to hear the Beatles playing and just, like, really got attached to them. And he was inspired by when Ringo Starr got tonsillitis in 1964 and was replaced by Jimmy Nicol for, like, 8 weeks on tour.
Yeah.
And he's like, what must that be like? To, like, what was his life like for, like, 8 weeks is just kind of getting subbed in for this huge band or whatever. And that was kind of the impetus of the idea, and it had been kicking around in his brain for 3 decades, basically. But he wrote the first treatment while he was doing Forrest Gump, because he was doing Forrest Gump and Philadelphia, and he was just caught up in all of that press and Oscar buzz and all these things. He's like, I needed something completely separate. I needed something completely unrelated to any of that that I could just pour myself into as like a safe haven. So he wrote an 11-page treatment during Forrest Gump. He started working on the first draft, wrote the first draft in about 3 months. He would regularly call up Nora Ephron and workshop it with her.
Oh,
and he would pick her brain about it. And he's like, because she would be really honest with me of like, you have too many characters, like you've got to focus in on these things. And like, she was really helpful kind of honing all of this together. He started talking with Jonathan Demme, who had worked on with Philadelphia. And he's like, I really want you to produce this. And he's like, I think this is really great. I think you should get in touch with these other people who would be a better fit for this. But like, I want to support you. And so Demme helped pass the film along to like a development stage, but they removed Hanks's name from the script so that it could just be judged on its own merits from investors. And people really loved it. And it was like considered high priority. They're like, this is a really fun script before they even knew Tom Hanks was involved.
Yeah.
So they did like a very underground early reading. Ethan Hawke was there. He played one of the band members this early reading.
90s Ethan Hawke?
Yeah. But Steve Zahn was also there, and that's how he got in with all of this, is that he and Ethan Hawke had done, they owned a theater company together with a few other people, and so he you know, let him know about this. He went, that's how Tom Hanks met him, and they were like, oh, okay, great. And so that was kind of the impetus of all of this. And Tom Hanks talks about how, like, when he was writing it, he really wanted the option for viewers to like pick your favorite wonder the way you could with the Beatles. He's like, everybody should have their screen time. Everybody should have their moment, and kind of put it all together. So he starts working on casting once the script is greenlit. It's really funny because, Tom Everett Scott, who plays Guy Patterson, the lead, he really liked Tom in the audition. And the first thing he said to him, he's like, are you sick of people telling you that you look like me? And he's like, yeah. He's like, it's a lot. He's like, I get it a lot. And he really liked Tom Scott, but he wasn't going to cast him because he thought he looked too much like him.
Yeah, like Splash era Tom Hanks.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I don't know. He's like, I'm not crazy about this. I think it's something that, like, I don't want it to be that I'm just casting a stand-in for myself, you know, was kind of his idea. And so he was going to pass on him, but back at home, he was watching through all of these and just kind of had them on the TV while he was doing his stuff. And while that was going on, his wife, Rita Wilson, was like, hey, who is this guy? And he's like, I was shaving in the other room and I heard his voice. I'm like, oh, that's Tom Scott. I liked him a lot. He's like, he looks too much like me, though. And she's like, well, he doesn't look that much like you, and he's really good. Like, I don't know. And so she kind of campaigned for him and got him the role and convinced Tom Hanks. He's like, no, he is kind of the best one that we saw, wasn't he? Which I just thought was kind of fun and cute.
And this is Tom Everett Scott's first movie, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's just very fun and cute. Rita Wilson is also featured in this movie. She plays Marguerite, waitress
really?
At the jazz club.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's her. Huh. But what's really interesting is that the band, like the band members in the film, they trained to actually play their instruments. They worked for like 2 or 3 months before anything even happened after they were cast, because they're like, okay, we need to just figure out how to handle this. We need to figure out how to like work as a band and know our instruments and like be able to sell this. And it started out initially as just wanting to get them comfortable, but then very quickly they became a pretty good band. Like they work really well. And so they do all the playing and the singing in the movie. And it's really funny. Jonathan Sinetsch, who plays Jimmy, he talks about how like the first time they went, they you know, get there and they have their trainers, and their trainer described Jonathan, like they handed him a guitar. He's like, it was like we handed him like a giant fish. He had no idea, like the most awkward holding of an instrument you'd ever seen in your life, but just like very quickly became a lot more comfortable. But the reason I bring this up is because when they did their read through with the cast, Tom Hanks told them, he's like, hey, I would really love whenever we get to a song in the script, you guys hop up and play the song and sing and then sit back down and like, just, we can get like a full feel of it. And they all took it to heart. So they went and got matching suits for the read through that they wore. And then each time they just hop up over to like their kits and play and then come sit back down.
That's adorable.
It's really cute. And everybody just had a really fun time. And like, that seemed to be the energy throughout the whole shoot, was just like,
I was going to say, I feel like you can really sense in watching the movie that everyone was having fun making this.
Totally.
You know,
like that's what Liv Tyler talks about in her interviews, is that she's like, your cheeks would hurt every day after shooting because she's like, we would all just goof around and have so much fun. Tom Hanks talks about how like him and Steve Zahn had a competition of just trying to crack the other person up during a scene because they both are just like are on the same wavelength with their comedy and would just toss zingers back and forth at each other. But yeah, everybody just really, really loved it. Tom Hanks talked about how he was nervous about like what it would be like acting and directing at the same time. But he's like, I actually really enjoyed it, because he said, as a director, I can influence the scene as it's happening because I'm an actor in the scene. If I don't like the way things going, or if I want to like adjust things slightly, he's like, I have an influence now.
He's in the take.
Yeah, exactly. So, I just never really thought about it that way. But I was like, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Of just having an influence while it's happening in that way. But yeah, you know, that's kind of the broad overview of everything. Again, it's a little bit of a cult classic on a budget of $26 million and only made $35 million. So considered a financial failure, but you know, again, I think I couldn't find numbers for it, but I have seen people talk about how like this was one of those cases of a 90s movie kind of having a new life on video. Like rental sales and DVD purchases were a lot higher than expected. But again, I couldn't find an actual figure. But so just kind of a general overview of the way this movie was put together and made.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I feel like we should probably do a summary.
I think so.
So, I mean, would you like to take a stab at that?
Sure. Or? I can handle that.
Great.
Okay. So that thing you do, we open meeting Guy Patterson, our main character, who works at his...
Our titular character.
That thing you do. he's working at his family's appliance store, and we get kind of a glimpse of his life during the opening credit scene of he's pretty good at his job, doesn't seem to like it a whole lot. And whenever the day is done, he sticks around and he's got a drum kit in the basement and he puts on his favorite jazz record and he plays drums along with the jazz record. And that's kind of his life. And that's what we see. His father is very belligerent in a very goofy way. He calls him up and talks about it. He's like, hey, why are the lights still on? Like, what are you doing? Just kind of, you're stupid. Come on, turn off the lights. It's nighttime. And so all this stuff. And then we very quickly get introduced to the rest of the bandmates. Guy goes out for breakfast and he runs across some friends of his. Something else that's kind of interesting is during the documentary, Tom Hanks has like detailed dossiers on all of these characters. Like, this is not a lore-heavy movie, but he's got it all. He's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Guy, he was in the army and stationed in Germany, and that's where he met Lenny, and all these details about all this stuff that never comes up in the movie, but, like, it, you know, at least helps the actors, I suppose.
Yeah.
But he goes to breakfast, and he meets the rest of the group there, and they're off talking amongst themselves. And there's Jimmy, Lenny, Chad, and TB.
TB.
Who is the bass player, which Tom Hanks said was kind of just an in-joke about how most bands, you only ever care about the guitarists and the singers. Like, out of the whole group, like, the bass player is kind of put to the side. And so he's like, we just didn't give him a name, which I thought was very funny. And Jimmy's girlfriend, Faye. And so they're all hanging out, and you get a sense of the dynamic very quickly. Jimmy is the tortured artist. He's locked, and he's like trying to think of a band name and all this stuff. And Lenny's the goofball. The bass player is just very quiet. And Chad is just sort of, you don't get much of a feel for Chad because Chad's going to be replaced very quickly.
But I'm certain that his history is long and interesting.
I'm sure.
And if we ever get a chance to ask Tom Hanks, we should ask him about Chad.
What
drove Chad to jump over the parking meter?
Wow.
And break his arms. You know, what drove Chad to fall down?
Yeah. So, they talk to Guy for a little bit, invite him to this talent show they're playing. And he's like, I'm probably going to be busy, but you know, best of luck or whatever. The band then goes off. They're all hanging out just around town. And like you said, Chad tries to jump over a parking meter, and he slips and falls and breaks his arm. So then Lenny and Jimmy go and they find Guy, and they're like, hey, can you please sub in tonight? Like, are you still playing drums? We really need a drummer. Chad broke his arm. It's a one day thing. Like, don't worry about it. And he's like, yeah, sure. And so He goes, rehearses with the band, and they're playing the titular That Thing You Do. See, used it correctly that time.
It's wild that they named the song after this guy.
Yeah, crazy. And so it is a very ponderous, slow tempo ballad that Jimmy wants to do. And it's okay when you hear it. Like, it's like, all right, it's fine. They're talented, but you can just tell that guy's brains are oozing out his ears while he's playing. He's like, okay, whatever. And while he's sitting there, he's asking him, he asks him some question about, like, and it's just he either says it's just the one performance or it's just one chorus. I think he's like, there's just one something, right? And they're like, yep. He's like, wonderful. And he does a little riff. And Faye lights up and she's like, that's it. That's it. That's the name of the band. Like, the Wonders. She's like, and you know how, like, the Beatles use, you know, B-E-A-T is the Beatles. Like, we could be O-N-E, like, you know, the Wonders. And that becomes a very quick running gag of Jimmy jots it down. He's like, oh, that's so good. And he holds it up to Lenny. He's like, look, the Wonders. He's like, looks like the Oneaters. It's like, no. Yeah. Wonders. Got it. Looks like the Oneaters. Mm-hmm. And that is a running gag for the movie of just nobody can say their name right because they don't grasp the wordplay.
Not only that, the subtitles, whoever wrote the subtitles was committed.
They're committed. It's
and
really
every
good.
Time someone says the band name, the Wonders, they spell it O-N-E-D-E-R-S. And like are very specific in pronunciation of O-Neaters versus O-Netters, which is also said.
Yeah. They get it all.
I'm sure they were just relieved when they changed the name to just the Wonders spelled proper.
Totally. So shout out to whoever was doing the subtitles on the Blu-ray. You're king.
Yeah.
Incredible. So they go to the Mercyhurst talent show, this local college. And while they're there, we meet Guy's girlfriend, Tina, played by a first performance
or
Charlie Theron.
Or do we? Parker, we watched the extended edition of this movie.
We did.
The director's cut.
We did. Well, we watched, yeah, and we've seen both.
And Tina's in the second scene.
True. Is that the one you want me summarizing?
No.
Okay. I figured I'd go with the one most people had seen.
Just wanted to clarify that we did, because we did say it last time, that we did watch the extended version.
We did watch the extended version. We're going to talk
Parker
about that
is,
after
but,
the
and
summary.
And we will, but Parker is summarizing the normal
yes.
edition.
I figured that was going to be the most populous.
Just the basic short version.
Yeah.
Without all the lore.
Without all the
Spartacus
lore.
And such.
Yeah. So we in the theatrical cut, we meet Tina, played by a first film performance, Charlize Theron, which is wild. Just be like,
she's 21 here. Mm-hmm. She's 21 in this movie.
Yeah, very young.
Looks completely different to me.
Very much so. And we get a feel for Tina. She is kind of the typical vapid blonde of the era, kind of that stereotype. Doesn't want to be there. She's like, I thought we were going out to like dinner in the club. Like, what are we doing here? Why are we here? He's like, I got to do this thing. She meets Faye and it kind of gives you a very clear, like, here's the blonde bombshell and the girl next door vibe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Band gets up on stage. They start playing and immediately Guy picks up the tempo a lot. And Jimmy is screaming at him. He's like, slow down. And he won't listen. And so they're desperately trying to play together. And it's really funny at the beginning because Jimmy is refusing to listen. He's still, you doing that thing. Like, he's trying to slow it down. Guy isn't listening. Yeah. The rest of the band isn't listening. And slowly but surely, the rest of the band is like, oh, hey, this is better. This is a lot better, faster. Crowd starts to form. People are loving it. Eventually, Jimmy concedes, starts singing in tempo, and they just kind of mesh. And this is the first time we hear the song in its full glory. And it's kind of an earworm. Like, that's like talking about film Twitter. I see this brought up a lot of like people ask, like, what is the best like fictional song in a movie, like in universe song? And this comes up all the time. They're like, I don't know. It slaps, man. It only exists in this movie and it's so good.
Yeah.
To the point that if you listen to this song on Spotify, all of the songs listed are attributed to their film characters. So it's like the Wonders.
Yeah.
And that just makes me happy. And then the band just kind of, you know, blows up. Everybody's losing their minds. They win the talent show, which has a reward, $100. split four ways.
Which you did the math, and that's more like $1,000 today. Is
yeah.
that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like $1,000, which is yeah pretty good for a college talent show.
Absolutely.
So they win the talent show, and immediately they're rushed by a local restaurant owner, Tony Villapiano, who mm-hmm. wants them to come. He's like, I need you guys. You're amazing. Like, come play at my restaurant, which is a Italian place out by the airport. And mm-hmm. so they get their first paid gig, you know, playing in at a restaurant, and they're all very excited about it. And they go, and afterwards they're driving home, and guy's with Tina, and he's just really excited about it. He's like, man, he's like, I love this so much. She doesn't care. She's fishing about Faye. She's like, oh, hey, yeah. Faye's kind of cute. He ignores her. He's just like in the moment of just like, man, I love playing drums. Like I did a band with my uncle. It sucked, but like, we're really good. We're award winning now. Like, isn't that exciting? And so.
Yeah. 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 And something that I really like about these like first kind of scenes of them playing together as a band is that you get the sense that like Erie, Pennsylvania feels very small. Mm-hmm. Like the call. I really like that this is set in a college. I just feel like there's a very lacking college mm-hmm. Setting for movies about like musicians, that sort of thing. It feels like there's always kind of the draw of like high schoolers, like 18, like yeah. 16, 17, 18, that I like that these are like 20-year-olds, 20-somethings. Totally. I think that's really fun. But also just like the nature of like the kid who keeps yelling out at the talent show. Is really fun. And then like the restaurant too, just mm-hmm. it just feels very like, yeah, this feels like a very origin story of a town,
yeah,
kind of position. I think they sell that well here.
Totally. So. Yeah, I agree. And that's something I like that as well. And I think it's a really good element throughout all of this. So yeah, they've got their first gig. So they go to Villapiano's, they're playing Jimmy's kind of boring ballad, All My Only Dreams, which title, like you and I sat and were like, that kind of means
first,
nothing.
But only for the first time this time.
Yeah.
I've seen this like a few times
mm-hmm.
and like twice in the last, you know, I saw it like a few yeah. months ago. And I'd never picked up on it until this watch where I was like, All My Only Dreams. Like, you are all my only dreams.
Yeah.
All like, what is that, Jimmy?
Yeah. What are you doing, Jimmy?
Really that good of a writer? I don't know.
I don't know. And so they're playing that. And they get some smattering of applause. And then that same kid who was razzing the host at the college show came to see them because he loves their music. He's like, when are you going to play that thing you do? And so they play that. Everybody loses their mind kind of a thing. And they have a really successful set. We have a very quick joke of Guy once again leaving the lights on and his dad has to come turn them off. That's a family quote that my family does all the time. Is just his dad's little rant as he gets out of the car. Back at Villapiano's, night is over. They get their money for the gig and they're hanging out. And the same kid is like, hey, love your music. Love the song. Want to know where I can get the record. And he's ushered out because it's after hours. And Guy's like, hey, what do you think about that? Like, we could do a record. And they're like, we're not a real band. Like, this is just a thing we're doing. He's like, no, like we could make a record that people listen to. We could sell it here for like $1 a piece. Like, couldn't that be exciting? And so they all decide, yeah, let's do that. And he's like, hey, I've got an uncle in the music industry. And Lenny gives him some shit about it. He's like, oh, Uncle Bob. He records church music. But they know a guy who can help them record. And so that's one of my favorite smash cuts in history is they're at Villapiano's talking about it. And he's like, well, he wouldn't do it for free, and we'd have to watch our language. And in the middle of that thing you do, there is, like, a moment where it builds, where it's like, and I just can't take it anymore. And it goes into a scream. It's like, wow! And I do it quietly, because I don't want to blow out the mic. And
oh,
just
yeah, that
on...
Was really, that, yeah. that was really gentle.
Yeah,
that
it's, a gentle, really, it's a gentle scream.
It was really, wow!
Yeah, it's an ASMR scream. Here we are.
Lo-fi today. That thing you do.
But just on the scream, it smash cuts to a stained glass window of Jesus. And I don't know. Yeah. That just makes me laugh every time to just hear a rock scream and then Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's good stuff. Yeah, they record with Uncle Bob. They've got the records. They come back to Villa Piano's. They're selling
a cameo by Chris Isaacs.
Yes, cameo by Chris Isaacs. Hello, Chris Isaacs as Uncle Bob.
Who may suck now? That's a headline that might have passed through my mind in the last little bit. Not like I made it up.
Sure.
Like, yeah. I saw it and it passed through my mind. Not just
I saw it in my mind's eye.
I might have just said, I think Chris Isaacs sucks now.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know. Just throwing that out there as well. But Chris Isaacs is there.
Yeah,
he cameos as Uncle Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Very 90s cam. Very like
totally
mid to late 90s cameo.
Yeah.
For this. Yeah.
Not
as many 90s cameos, though, as you'd think.
You'd think,
like,
right? Yeah.
Like there would, it feels like they'd have a lot more fun with that with like the Playtone stable of artists.
Totally.
They'd be like, and here's a person. I mean, I think it works that it's not that.
Yeah.
But you'd almost expect it.
You would expect it, I think. So they get the record. They start selling them. Back at Villa Piano's, a mysterious gentleman picks up one of them. We're like, who could that be?
Thanos.
Thanos. They play their set. It is not Josh Brolin.
The JFK from Oppenheimer? Did they finally reveal him?
That's exactly right.
He's still alive at this point, right?
Yeah. Yeah, why not?
In universe?
In universe.
I like these boys. You know?
Incredible. So the next day, guy's still working his job. And this gentleman shows up, and his name is Phil Horace, and he works in the music industry. And
he drives a van. He drives a camper.
He drives a camper. He's like, "Would you like to step into my office?"
And he makes chili stew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that might be all he eats.
That might be all he eats. But this dude lives out of his camper.
But he does make a good. He's like, "I think music's like a stew."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "If there's no meat to it or something, then it's a soup." Or something.
Yeah, he's just like
something
like
that.
He's like, "You need a lot of different elements, and it all comes together." You know.
Yeah, and if it doesn't, it's not a soup.
Yeah,
he ends with soup.
Yeah,
feels
it's just
soup derogatory,
just soup.
Which
yeah,
which is hey.
Yeah, why are we taking pot shots
hey.
At soup? What's that about?
It's rude. Yeah, what about that, Phil Horace? All right, sorry. Continue.
You're good. So he offers them a contract. He says, "Hey, let me be your manager." He's like, "I'll promote you." He's like, "I'm gonna get you on the radio, serious airtime." He's like, "If it doesn't happen within a week, 10 days at the most," he's like, "rip at this contract. I'm not your manager." Another
which
no, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, please.
What were you going to say?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, we're being too polite. I'm sure it's not as fun to listen to. but I was going to say that Jimmy is immediately like, "I don't know how I feel about signing anything about my music."
Yeah.
And he's right, but the way he says it makes me want to tell him to stop talking.
That's most of Jimmy's lines, is that sometimes he's right, but also I'm like, do you have to be a prick about it? Like, do you have to, does your intonation have to be so uppity?
It's something that is kind of solved in the one scene that I really liked in the extended edition. Not the one, I mean, there's more,
sure.
But like them in the theater when they go to, you know, not to skip ahead, but like Boss Van Koss's mm-hmm. theater, and they're all standing on stage and they all just start doing silly dances. And Jimmy does that too.
Yeah.
I think that really helps to cement Jimmy as like, well, there's a reason all these guys are in a band with him.
Totally.
There's a reason that they're friends with him. Sometimes I feel like in the movie it starts to be like,
yeah, it's like, why is he here?
What's your problem, Jimmy?
Totally.
Like, why are you in a band if you don't want to be in a band?
Yeah, I agree.
You know, or like, why does everyone else put up with you? I'd hate that. Mm-hmm. But that is one thing that I think comes across more.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think most of his intonation is very...
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is fine, and it works, and it's a great performance for the character.
Totally, I agree. But yeah, so that was, you actually just hit it on the head. I was going to bring that similar thing up of, you know, Jimmy is really hesitant about it, and Lenny has one of the better, like, it's just Steve Zahn is so funny in this movie, but Jimmy's like, "I don't know, I'm hesitant to sign anything about my music." And Lenny goes, "Are you kidding? A man in a really nice camper wants to put our music on the radio." Like, where's a pen? Give me a pen. I'm signing. You're signing. We're all signing. And we
God bless Steve Zahn in this movie.
God bless Steve Zahn in this movie, man. He's I love.
Have you
Lenny.
Seen him in much else? What else is?
I mean, he had a run as the dad in the Diary of a Wimpy Kids movie.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
I bet that's at the top of his name for IMDb. I bet it's it's not Greg. What's their, I don't know what their dad's name is. Mr. Heffley. Mm-hmm. And then it's Lenny.
Yeah.
And then he's in
War for the Planet of the Apes.
And then War for the,
yeah.
Yeah.
What a top three.
Those are his three. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like Steve Zahn, and I'm always very, very happy when he pops up. I'm very happy when any of these people pop up. Quick aside.
Yeah.
Tom Everett Scott shows up at the end of La La Land. And like, it was literally really? Like, it was me doing the Leonardo DiCaprio scene. I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. He's the husband.
He's Emma Stone's husband.
Mm-hmm.
She married a different jazz guy.
Yeah.
You should talk to Ryan Gosling.
Yeah,
in that movie.
He should. They'd have a lot to talk about. White dudes loving jazz.
What? yeah. My favorite movies. My favorite movie genre. White dudes loving jazz.
Exactly.
No, I don't want to watch a movie where anyone else likes jazz.
No.
I'm a white man, and therefore I only like jazz if a white man likes it.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what I'm getting.
That's what I'm hearing.
Let me clarify. That intonation means it was a joke.
It was a joke. Joke present.
There are a lot of movies about white men loving jazz. True. And that's great.
Yeah. I am also a white man who loves jazz.
Wow, you should talk to Tom Everett Scott and Ryan Gosling.
So they signed this contract. I can't remember the exact like chronology of this. Somewhere during this section, we have one quick cutaway of Tina going to see her new dentist, who is really mm-hmm. hot. And then she disappears from the movie.
And that's her character exit.
That's yeah. it. Yeah, she's out.
Or is it?
So we cut to the band, and they're all kind of trying to listen. They've got these little portable radios that in the extended cut, we see that Guy gives them to everybody to listen. But everybody's got these portable radios, and they're listening, trying to find if their music is playing anywhere. And it's not.
Yeah.
We see the bass player.
I will say there's one thing about the extended cut that I think is not necessarily necessary. I see why they would cut it out. It's them doubting Phil Horace.
Yeah.
Like there's a scene at breakfast where they're like, he's ripped us off, man. He's a crook. And I just feel like we don't have the time for that.
No.
Like we're still in act one. We don't.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't need to have them doubt this guy. We can just skip to the song on the radio.
The extended cut's so interesting because it's kind of a 50-50 split between like really good character moments that I'm glad are there. And then stuff that is so superfluous that it's like, yeah, it doesn't need to be here. And it makes sense why it's cut.
Yeah.
So they're all listening. The bass player's at like the Army Surplus store picking out outfits, which will come back later.
Huh?
Huh? Guy's working at the appliance store, and Liv Tyler is just mailing some letters. And she's sitting there licking her stamps, and she hears it's like, you know, that was such and such. And hey, we've got something new for you today. A local Erie band just won the Mercyhurst Talent Show. Here's their song, That Thing You Do. And this is the scene you were talking about on film Twitter. She just freaks out. Oh my God! And just excitedly shoves her letters. And well, first she runs away and she forgets to put them in. And it's really cute. She comes back and remembers to put the mail in. Finds the bass player, just screams at him. He's like, you're on the radio!
It's really funny. His scream back is really funny. It's less excited and more terrified.
Yeah, he's just...
They take off down the street.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Get to Guy's dad's appliance store. Throw open the doors. They're freaking out. Steve Zahn and Jimmy show up.
Just park in the middle of the road.
Park in the middle of the road. Get out. Run in. And they all just have a big cheer.
Yeah. They turn on every radio in the store. Tune it in. They're screaming. They're laughing. They're running around. There's a really good moment where Steve Zahn almost gets the actress playing Guy's sister to break character, and you see her like crack up a little bit where he stands there, he's like, yeah, and there's this cutout display of like a woman in a magician's outfit, and he just grabs it and kisses it. She's so surprised that he does that and like curls her lips in trying not to crack up, and I'm glad they keep that in the final cut.
It is fun.
But yeah, they're all very, very excited about it. Guy calls Tina about it that night, and she is very uninterested and doesn't care. And he's like, hey, yep, we're going, you know, it played all this time, and isn't that great? And we get some shorthand of a scene that was deleted where he's like, yeah, we're going to Pittsburgh. We're going to play an actual show in Pittsburgh. And he's like, you should come. He's like, oh, I'm spending all day at the dentist. Like, I can't make it. Oh, no. And she just hangs up on him in the middle of their conversation.
What's quite frightening about the extended edition is that she's just continuously going back for more dental work. It's not that she's, and it's not simple procedures either. No. He's like putting shots into her mouth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that can't be good for you.
No.
Can't be good for you to just every day be getting numbed up, you know?
No, I don't think so. Especially, I mean, I know he's hot, but it's not worth it.
It's not worth it.
No.
Anyway, I'm glad they cut that out in the final cut, because that means it didn't happen. That means it no longer happened. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. The band gets to Pittsburgh, and they're going to play this show for Boss Vic Hoss, who is a kind of local celebrity. He's not unlike Abe Froman in Ferris Bueller. He is the mattress king of Pittsburgh. And all of his jokes are mattress related for some reason, and you miss that.
That's why he makes the sleeping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How are you sleeping? Yeah. And they say, "It hit me," or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I did not get that at all. I thought he was just like an entertainment guy.
Nope, he sells mattresses, which then allows him to run this rock show that he does.
Okay. All right.
Yep. And so the band, they get there and they're gonna play. And they have all sorts of technical issues. The mics aren't on, and then they are on, and they're just screeching into the audience, and everybody hates it. One of Guy's cymbals falls over. It's a bad performance.
Yep.
And Guy is really upset and nervous about it.
Yeah, and they don't subject us to it.
No, they don't. We get a little bit of it, and then we cut away, because like, nope, don't watch the embarrassment. It's too much.
Yeah.
And Guy is really upset about it, and he's kind of almost considering quitting the band. He's like, I was like a wind-up monkey toy up there. Like, I can't do this. And Guy's like, you know what you need? You need exotic. You need to sample the exotic cuisine of the Far East. So they go inside, and they see the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Thomas Hanks.
Wow. And he's looking sinister.
He's looking kind of sinister.
Him, the way they shoot him makes him look a little sinister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something about the lighting in the scene.
Yep. So he's there, and Phil introduces him, and he's like, hey, this fellow here, he is with Playtone Records, Mr. White. And he's like, he just caught the show. And Guy's like, oh, great, cool. And he's like, well, hold on. And Tom Hanks is like, yeah. He's like, I heard your record. And he's like, I like it. He's like, that thing you do, it's really snappy. I like it a lot. And he's like, we think you'd be a really good fit for Playtone. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, it feels too good to be true. He's like, we play one bad show and you want to offer us like a major record deal? Like, that's crazy. And they negotiate a little bit, talk about it. And Guy is like, well, I need to, he's like, he's really loyal to Phil. He's like, well, Phil's our manager. Like, I don't know. I really like him. And Phil's like, no. He's like, you're missing the point. He's like, don't get stuck up on me. He's like, this is your ticket. Like, take it, go for it. Like, I'm just happy I got you this far, you know? And he's very amicable about it. But Guy immediately is like, I got to talk to the rest of the band. He's like, you see, he's smart kid. Mr. White meets the rest of the band. He officially changes their names. He's like, we're dropping the O-N-E. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't work. You're just going to be the Wonders.
Personally, thank God.
Yeah, it's a good call.
It stresses me out every time.
Yeah, me too. And so, yeah, it's finally gone. It's taken care of. And now all is well and good to go.
And he kind of assigns everybody different things. Like, he's like, okay, well, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And then he gives Guy a pair of sunglasses. And he says, from now on, you keep those on. You never take them off, you know? And then he asks Faye, who is she?
Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, well, yeah.
She just gets to hang out.
She just gets to hang out. He's like, oh, you want her on tour? She's your costume mistress. Fine, whatever. Yeah. Which is really fun and cute, because he seems, never to her face, but just like this first initial reaction to Faye, he doesn't like that she's there and coming along. But throughout the movie, there's very cute little moments where he's taking care of Faye, and like that develops. And I'm like, that's nice. I like that.
Yep.
So yeah, they head off on tour. But it's revealed that the bass player, he's like, all right, we're just going to tour until October. And the bass player is like, I can't. He's like, I signed up for the Marines back home, and I've got a report at the end of August. And everybody's kind of pissed about that. And he's like,
but you'll remain with the band until the end of August.
Yes, sir. That's the exchange. Yeah. And again, like, it's interesting because they do introduce him visually as an antagonist and as the bad guy. But very quickly, even in this he's not that. He's like, nice. You know, he gives guys some sunglasses. He's like, try wearing these shades. See what the world looks like through those. And he points to the bass player. He's like, and you, Simplify. And then walks out. And like, they give him little moments like that of being likable Tom Hanks, you know, which is nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, then from there, it's kind of just a rapid fire. They go on tour and we get this montage.
They're wearing red suits. Parker, because they enter the Playtone stable of artists, which is my favorite weird little phrase in this movie of like, why are you calling a stable of artists? Playtone stable of artists. They go on tour with like this touring Playtone kind of extravaganza. Mm-hmm. And they get to meet other artists. They get to meet the guy who sings Mr. Downtown, which I 100% just thought was a real song. It still happened. I until this last watch with you and you were like, huh, you know, this character, you know, oh, he really sells it. And I was like, but it's a real song, though.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't think so. And sure enough, it wasn't. But they do get red suits.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I pose you the question, Parker. They get three suits, right? Mm-hmm. They get the red, they get the gold, and they get the black.
Yeah.
And the top quote on IMDb is Tom Hanks saying, you boys look good in gold. Have I ever told you that? And I don't know why that's the top quote on there.
Yeah,
a lot of people really like that. But I don't think they look good in gold.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a weird mustardy color.
It's not their best.
That I think for the most part doesn't look great. And I think the red looks good. And I think the black when they're on TV looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all.
Yeah. And so now they've made it and they're on tour and we get some montage stuff. And something very interesting about this movie that I was thinking about is like, you would kind of expect this to be structured more like a typical like musical biopic of like the rise to fame or whatever. But it takes its time a lot more. Like we're at the halfway point of the movie and they just got famous, you know?
Yeah.
Well, whereas.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just like usually that would be like, I don't know, the inciting incident. Like that's usually what happens in biopics is that it's like, the band, it happens. Whoa, they're famous now. Like it very quickly gets to that point. And this one, like the first half is that kind of small town feel, local band.
Yeah.
Which I really like.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, you say it does montage stuff, but it also isn't doing necessarily the exact, like, I mean, it does have like songs going up the charts, which I feel like is a staple of the genre. Mm-hmm. But it also has like full scenes in between. It's not just completely brushing past the tour. Like a large chunk of this second half of the movie is them on tour, you know, and like learning about things and like Jimmy interacting with what's her name and scenes at bars. Like, I think it makes that work. And I think it's something that you pointed out during this watch is like, this movie doesn't have like rising conflict. Like really, like obviously we're building to, you know, Jimmy blowing up and leaving the band and the band ends. But like, it's not like we're doing the rise of the band and then the fall of the band, you know, it's just kind of all happening at once, which I think really works in this movie's favor of showing what it would be like to be in this band of like, it's not so linear. It's like the song's moving up the charts while we're touring. It's not, we tour, the song reaches the top of the charts, we fall apart, you know, it's like, it's all happening at the same time, which makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I just think that's kind of like something that the structure of the film follows and is able to do because this movie isn't explicitly following the rise and fall. It's just kind of exploring what this brief, like happenstance would be like for these characters.
Nope. I agree. Yeah, so we get this montage. During all of this, we see that Jimmy starts getting close with one of the other singers, Diane Dane, who is kind of a musical diva in, you know, probably like her mid-40s, late-40s kind of a thing. And she and Jimmy are very flirty. And it's one of those things where it's like, dude, you're dating Liv Tyler and she's obsessed with you. What are you doing? But another one of those moments,
well,
like, boom,
well, in
Jimmy.
Fairness, they used a really odd picture of Liv Tyler for the cover of the movie. So
they did. That's a very good point.
You know, no, but not really.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Well, Jimmy just sucks, you know,
Jimmy
boo, as you say.
Boo on
say.
Jimmy.
Boo on Jimmy.
This whole section kind of gets capped off with they do a performance and then they go back down to the dressing rooms and Tom Hanks has received some news and he's like, hey, that thing you do is like the highest selling single in the history of the label. Like you guys now are like number 7 on Billboard. You have a top 10 record. And he's like, yeah. We're flying out to coast, like state tours are small potatoes. We got to move. So they're off to California now. They've got one more big thing.
One more
and
big thing.
So they hop on, they rush out and you get your Beatles scene of everybody going nuts for the band and all the girls are like, shade, shade, shades.
Put the shades on.
Give them what they want. Give them what they want. They freak out.
As they're getting into the limo, Liv Tyler gets separated from the group. Faye is held back by guards who think that she's just another fan.
Yeah.
Jimmy just gets in the car. But Guy, Skitch, if you will.
Skitch.
comes back and gets her.
Yeah.
And something that they do in the extended cut is more flesh out the friendship between Guy and Faye. And I think that is something that is missed a little bit in the final cut, in like the theatrical cut.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I just thought that, you know, obviously this is a big moment.
Yeah, I agree. And so yeah, they take care of that and they get her in and they're off to the coast. And on the airplane, Faye is sick. She's not feeling well. And so Guy takes care of her. He lays down a pillow and he's like, You have a fever. You need a lace here, you need to take care. So she gets some rest. He goes back to Lenny comes in, he says, hey, Guy, meeting with Hair Playtone. So he has to go talk to Tom Hanks. And another one of those little character moments, he sits down and the first thing he says, he's like, I don't think Faye's feeling very well. He's sitting next to Jimmy. And Jimmy looks at him and ignores him. He goes, when are we cutting our next record?
Yeah.
Like, he just doesn't care at all about Faye.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ugh, don't like it.
He's on that musician grind, Parker.
I guess so. I suppose so. He's just got to focus in. Lock in, I suppose. But Tom Hanks tells them, he's like, hey, we're going to go. We're staying at this nice hotel. You guys are going to be in a major motion picture. And we're going to go and we're going to promote the record. You have to go make, he's like, we have to go make pilgrimage and meet Saul Seiler, the head of Playtone. You got to go pay your respects. He's like, and if I can manage it, we're going to try to get you guys on live TV on the Hollywood Television Showcase.
Yeah.
Before everybody, which is kind of their sub-in for the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yep.
And so they're like, great. They get there. They're in California. The major motion picture that they're doing is a Jake and Anita movie.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of fluffy beach movie.
Very clam bake.
Very clam bake. Very much so. And they're playing the band. They're cameoing
as
a Captain Geach and the Shrimp Shack Shooters.
Yeah.
Jimmy is livid, doesn't want to be here, thinks he's like, we look like monkeys. What are we doing here? He's like, we should be making records. Everybody else is just happy to be there. They're having a good time. They're like, dude, this is silly. It's fun. Yeah. It's whatever. We're getting paid so much money to do this.
A cameo by Jonathan Demme, who appears as the director of the Jake and Anita movie.
Yep.
Very fun.
Yeah, very fun. They go to Playtone and they meet Mr. Saul Seiler, who is brass and loud. And something that's interesting, I do miss it in the theatrical cut. In the extended cut, he makes up some story about how he found the wonders.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm driving through Texas. I find this dive bar. There's these kids and they're playing. Everybody loves them. He's like, I sign them immediately. And they're all like, we've never been to Texas and we've never met you. But they're just kind of going with it. And Guy has a moment. He turns to Tom and he's like, you found us. You discovered. He's like, what does it matter? How did you enjoy Texas? Like, he's like, this is how it's played. This is how it's done. And I miss that in the theatrical cut. They just kind of, he's like, these are my new boys, the Wonders. And then he goes off.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy also approaches him.
Yeah, Jimmy approaches him. He's like, I have some new songs that I want to write. And he screams at him. He's like, you want to talk to me during my lunchtime?
Auditions during my lunchtime?
Yeah, Tom Hanks freaks out. He like, ushers him away.
Yeah.
Lenny meets this blonde bombshell.
A lot of blonde bombshells in this movie.
It's the era. What can I say? And so, you know.
It's the era, Max.
Yeah, come on, Max.
In the 60s, you could either be blonde bombshell, girl next door.
Girl next door.
Or other woman.
Other woman. And so Lenny meets this girl and he hits it off with her. Her name's Kitty. And so they go back to the hotel and Jimmy's really upset. He's like, this guy doesn't even know who we are. He probably hasn't even heard that thing you do. He's like, this is the man in control of like our creative destinies. He's really upset about it. Lenny doesn't care. He's like, oh yeah. Oh no. A bunch of lying snakes paying us, putting us up in a 5-star hotel. Like, oh geez. And Jimmy's like, Diane Dane warned me about this. And Faye gets kind of tense. Mm-hmm. And Guy also picks up on it. And he's like, well, Diane Dane, what'd she have to say? He's like, never trust a label. And I'm starting to believe her. And Lenny gives him some shit about it. And he's like, I'm sorry, I'm bugging you. I guess I'm alone in my principles. And Lenny gets, in my opinion, the best joke in the movie.
It is.
Jimmy storms off. He's like, oh no, there he goes off to write that hit song, Alone in My Principles.
It's really good. It's really funny. Natural delivery from Steve Zahn.
Yeah, he's great. Faye tries to defend Jimmy with the craziest thing. She's like, you guys have to understand, like, in high school, Jimmy tested at genius levels. So that's why he's not, you know. And they're all just kind of quiet. And she's like, I feel terrible. I'm going to go lay down. And so she leaves. Lenny goes off with his date. And Guy and the bass player are going to go check out L.A. They run into some Marines in the lobby, and immediately the bass player is like, I'm going to be joining your ranks soon, and I can already do 100 push-ups.
So the Marines like, do it right now.
Do it right now. And so he starts hanging out with the Marines, and Guy's like, well, he's a lost cause. So he goes, and I'd skipped over the concierge, Lamar. Lamar is the best. We love Lamar.
A key player.
A key
in
player.
In that thing you do. Cannon.
He's the last shot of the movie. I mean,
and we'll get to that.
And so he asks Lamar, he's like, hey, is there any good places for jazz? He's like, oh, you want jazz, you want good jazz. And he tests him on some piece of jazz lore, like who played drums on this particular record. And he knows it. He's like, get in the cab. And he's like, take him to the blue spot. So he goes to this jazz club and Guy gets drunk. He's a happy drunk. He's a silly drunk. And he's interacting with Tom Hanks's wife, Rita Wilson. And
that's
she
so
takes
funny.
Like,
that's so funny that she's like, cast this boy. Mm-hmm. Yes, I will flirt with him at this bar.
Yes. And also, you can dress me up and frame me as looking very hot and sexy in this movie, Tom. Thank you.
And Tom went, oh, boy, you know, whatever. Tom Hanks impression. Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, he comes and she's talking to him and everybody else is like, it's winding down. The club is closing and she's still chatting him up and he's still drunk. And he's like, he's very uninterested. He's like, do you think they're going to play again? And she's like, I don't know. Looks like they're kind of busy with Del Paxton. He's like, Del Paxton, who is the guy he was listening to at the beginning of the movie and playing his record.
And
he's been talking
about
Del Paxton.
He's been talking
about
the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh my God, it's Del Paxton. And so he goes to meet Del, and they get introduced, and he does his silly, he over-explains himself. He's like, I've collected all your records, I'm part of a band, we're out here on the coast. You are my biggest fan.
Yeah.
He's just drunk, but he makes a decent impression, and he goes home for the night. Marguerite
well,
has a really...
They talk for a while.
Yeah,
and
they talk
he
for
says,
a while
I don't know what I don't know what's going to happen, and Del Paxton says, you know, sometimes you gotta, you know, bands don't last forever.
Yeah.
And Guy's like, but you know, we've only been playing for so long. And Del Paxton's like, I've been in bands that should never have been together in the first place.
Totally.
It's like, this will fall apart. The best thing you can do is keep playing and not be like so attached to one specific band, you know? And that's kind of his advice to him. And then he goes home
Yep. And goes home. And the next morning he wakes up to an angry phone call from Tom Hanks. So he's like, good morning, guy. Your bass player's disappeared off the face of the earth and you're on television in a few hours. He's like, get down to the studio. Freaks out, gets down there, doesn't know what's happening. Jimmy has gotten sick from Faye. He's thrown up in the bathroom. Lenny doesn't care. Lenny's just having a great time with his new ex-Playboy bunny girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And also one of my favorite cuts in the movie is guy is trying to track down their bass player. And he's on the phone. He's like, no, I've left 15 messages. And he hangs up the phone. He's like, where the hell is he? And it immediately cuts to the bass player and the Marines on Matterhorn at Disneyland
with the Mickey Mouse mascot.
And Mickey Mouse. They're just hanging out at Disneyland. So the bass player ran away to Disneyland with the Marines and he is never seen again.
It's a really great cut. I think you said that Steve Zahn's line that we said earlier is the best, like, you know, dialogue joke.
Yeah.
And this is the best visual gag in the entire movie. And it's really funny every time.
Totally. And so
they get them a new bass player.
They get them a new bass player,
Wolfman.
Mr. Wolfman.
And he, it's so funny because I get, like, it absolutely works for the character, but it's so annoying when Jimmy's like, well, do you think you can handle our song? And then he plays it and they're all like,
yep, he's like, I think I can handle it, Junior. Yep,
mm-hmm. Yeah, because he plays like a really cool riff.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about Wolfman is that he sticks around for quite a while.
Yeah, he does.
And is just kind of hanging out. And I told you, I think it'd be really funny if Wolfman just started being like, guys, it's awesome. We've really come a long way. But he's too professional for that. He's too professional to be made into a joke.
Yeah.
But he hangs out for a little bit.
Yep.
I think he's dismissed with a, you're the best, Wolfman, as he heads out or something like that.
But yeah, very, very, very similar.
But he's there to play
exactly
on TV.
Yep.
So they play
he's
on
there
TV.
To play on TV so they can do the Hollywood showcase. Guy has another moment of wanting to check in on Faye. He runs up to Mr. White. And he's like, hey, Faye's not going to miss this. And she's like, no, don't worry. I've taken care of her. And we get a very brief little shopping and makeup montage of her getting pampered. And it's very cute. And she looks great.
It is. And also in the extended edition, it's alluded to more so that Mr. White, played by Tom Hanks, is gay.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting. And only that the Beatles do exist in this movie. Mm-hmm. They exist in this universe.
Yeah, they make jokes about them.
And I just think it's really neat that these two bands both have gay managers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I do like that as well. And it's still there in the theatrical cut, but it's a lot more like explicit in the extended cut.
It's also interesting to... Something about this movie that I find really interesting is like to so... blatantly be playing off of the Beatles, but not to remove the Beatles entirely from the equation.
Yeah.
To have them still call, you know, Guy Ringo and like talk about the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's just so interesting to do both, to be like,
yes,
this band is pulling from, like, we're pulling from the Beatles story for this movie. And so, like, we have an Ed Sullivan Show, we have a Mr. Epstein. We have a, you know, whatever, this. We have the matching suits, but also the Beatles exist. And I find that interesting because it almost places the Wonders permanently, kind of locks them into their one-hit wonder status because there are so many bands from the 60s at that time who were just kind of forced into Beatles shapes, you know, because America was like, we need to have our own. I don't know. It's something that I find interesting that the movie plays with so directly and also does not just rid us of the Beatles or only have like one passing mention.
Totally.
Like if you only had the radio joke of like, no, not those ones, you know, of like mob heads from the East or whatever.
Yeah.
That would be like, oh, wow, that's so funny. But like by explicitly saying the Beatles and Ringo and stuff, it's just, I don't know. I find that interesting that
I agree.
That they do both.
Yeah. It's nice that they do both. I think it works in the movie's benefit for sure. But yeah, so they get to the Hollywood showcase and they perform That Thing You Do for, I think, the sixth time in the movie.
They do. And Guy's family's at home. His dad is a fan now.
Yeah.
He's excited
because he's made it.
Guy's
now
on TV.
Yeah. He's on TV. So now it's official. It's real.
Yeah.
So yeah, his family's watching. I skipped over Chad, the ex-drummer, starts working at Patterson's Appliance, so he's also
Guy
there.
Just swap lives, yeah. Really. What's Chad's story, Tom?
That's a good question.
Tell us about Chad.
Yeah. So they play, and everybody goes nuts, and it's a good performance. While they're playing, you've got the television people during the bridge of the song. They go and are doing these close-ups on everybody with little name tags attached to them. There's some really good stuff. They cut to Wolfman. Wolfman, too scary, cut. So they go to somebody else. And when they get to Jimmy, again riffing on the Beatles thing, it says Jimmy, and underneath it says, careful, girls, he's engaged.
Yeah.
And Jimmy, this is so funny to me because this isn't how television stations work. I don't think he would be able to see the monitor.
It shows him glance over to where a monitor might be.
Yeah. But why would a monitor be facing the performers?
They do that on, like... They do that with like live broadcasts.
Sure.
Typically, like I know that like in a news studio, you can look mm-hmm. over at yourselves on the TV.
Yeah.
Like that's just part of it.
Okay.
I don't know if that would be the same for a music performance, mm-hmm. especially in the 60s. I don't know, but
yeah,
I buy it.
Yeah.
At this point.
And so Jimmy sees this and Faye sees this and is very surprised and kind of, you know, happy about it, but Jimmy looks kind of irked. They finish their performance, go off stage. Backstage, they're having a confrontation about it because he thinks she did it. He's like, well, how did it just showed up by magic? He's like, am I supposed to give you a big diamond ring now? And he's being a real jerk about it. Like she even says, she's like, you're ruining this beautiful moment. Mm-hmm. He's like, where did you get the idea we're engaged? We're not. Like, that's the last thing on earth I need. And everybody else comes in, just, you know, high off of their performance, feeling good, and Faye requests, she's like, can I say something? And she has this little monologue talking about how she's like, I used to think that you cared about me, but you don't. Like, you save all of that love and life for your songs, and you don't put it into people. And she has a line that I really, really love, which is, shame on me for kissing you with my eyes closed so tight. And
it's
she breaks
good.
Up with him.
Parker, we're reaching the point where, unfortunately, I have to be mean.
Okay, be mean.
No, not mean. It doesn't feel natural to me for Faye to say all of this in this moment so eloquently. Mm. I don't know why. Something about it, like, we haven't seen Faye be so eloquent for the whole mm-hmm. movie. And then, like, she has, like, I have wasted thousands upon thousands of kisses on you.
Sure.
And like, it's gorgeous and I love the moment, but it feels really odd to me in context of Faye's character for most of the movie.
I can see that.
I don't know. That's my, it's like, it's a really nice monologue and it's a really nice sentiment, but it feels so odd for me when so much of this movie has such a naturalistic conversational vibe to it. And mm-hmm. some of the performance, but we'll get into that. Sorry. We'll get into that a little more after the end of the summary.
No, it's a good note. And I can totally see where you're coming from, for sure.
And that's just my personal experience.
Sure.
But
yeah, so Faye leaves. And Jimmy, again, has to have the last word. He's like, I should have dumped you in Pittsburgh. And he's really pissed about it. And everybody else leaves except for him and Guy. And they have their John Lennon moment. He's like, take those stupid sunglasses off. Which is interesting because up to this point, Guy and Jimmy really haven't had much of a relationship on screen.
They haven't.
So it's like, why are you two talking?
Because
like, why isn't
not,
this conversation with Lenny?
It's not like, you know, Jimmy saw Guy and Faye talking earlier in the movie and was
yeah.
like, you know, like he didn't care. Even if that mm-hmm. had been happening, he wouldn't have cared.
Right.
So it's interesting for him to suddenly like antagonize and be like, take those stupid sunglasses off. Like, you don't even see him being like, Mr. White's making you more of a star than me. And I'm the mm-hmm. right. You know, I feel like that's something that could exist here.
Yeah.
I'm sure that internally that's what Jimmy, the character, is feeling and thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. It's interesting that they don't really give them that much conflict.
No.
Together leading up to this moment. But it works. I think it works in the moment. I think him saying that, you get a sense that he's hated that the whole time.
Totally. So it's just, it's odd that like they put those two in the John and Paul roles when that should be Lenny and Jimmy.
But, yeah, Lenny and Jimmy have been, you know, writing together for a long time.
Right. So I don't, it is an odd little thing, and I get it because, like, in context of the movie, it is that, like, kind of non-existent love triangle between the three of them, which is why this conversation happens for, like, us, the audience. Yeah. But in context of the movie, it's just a kind of an odd choice. They get to the studio to record a new record. Jimmy is being belligerent. And he's like, we record my songs or we don't record at all. And Tom Hanks pulls rank on him. He's like, you didn't read the contract you signed. It says you do what I tell you to do. So you're going to cover other people's songs. You're going to record that thing you do in Spanish. Mm-hmm. He's like, and we'll give you some songs. He's like, I don't want any of your lover's lament crap. He's like, I want something snappy. I want something up-tempo. And Jimmy walks up to the mic and does something that the actor says people on the street will do to him constantly. Like, if people recognize him from the movie, they will come up to him and they go, I quit.
Yeah.
I quit. And they do his little song. So he quits the band and he leaves. And it's just a guy. Like, everybody else is gone. He's like, where's Lenny? He's like, I have no idea. Smash cut. Lenny is in Vegas and he got married.
And he's never been so happy.
He's never been so happy. Back at the studio, Tom Hanks, it's just him and Guy. Wolfman leaves and he's like, the Wonders are in breach of contract. And Guy gets really scared. He's like, I'm sorry. He's like, it's fine. He's like, no, bands break up. Nobody's going to prison. Jail.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I'm still part of a band and we still have a hit record. He's like, yeah, you do. He's like, you one hit wonders. It's a very common tale. And he tells him, hey, you can stick around if you want. You're out of the hotel today. Like, you're not on Playtone's record, Playtone's payroll anymore. And he tells him, he's like, you know what, Guy? He's like, Phil was right. He's like, you are the smart one. He's like, Lenny's the fool, Jimmy's the talent, and Faye's special, isn't she? And that's kind of the first time you see Guy even consider that he has feelings for Faye.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tom Hanks leaves. Guy stays in the studio. He just messes around on the drums. And a figure in the recording booth is listening. And he walks out and it's Del Paxton. And he remembers him from the club. And he's like, hey, let's jam together. He's like, oh, let's jam. Yeah. So they play together and it's very fun. And then he gets back to the hotel.
In the theatrical cut, Guy just returns to the hotel holding a bunch of stuff.
A box of stuff, and you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But the extended cut, he calls the dude from, like, the jazz radio station.
They went on the radio. That's one thing that we forgot to touch upon. They went on the radio earlier.
Went on the radio.
Guy talked about Del Paxton on the the radio, because the radio guy was like, what's the music that, you know, really kind of made you excited about music? And they all say whatever.
Yeah.
And then Guy is like, genuinely has real answers and talks about jazz. And the radio DJ is like,
So he calls this dude, tells him he's hanging out with Del Paxton. He's like, can you record talking to him? And he's like, I mean, yeah, I'm in a recording studio. He's like, if you get that, he's like, I'll give you a job. He's like, you can have the slot talking to jazz legends. Like, and so he has a job now. You miss all of that in the theatrical cut. You get a very clumsy ADR line when he's talking to Faye behind his head, where he's like, I think I might have found a job, so I'm going to stick around here. And that's all we get in theatrical cut.
Which is wild in the theatrical cut, because it's like, what's your job, playing, jamming with Del Paxton?
Yeah. It's like, okay,
that's
sure,
not a
I
job,
guess.
Guy. You can, like.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So he goes back to the hotel. Lamar is like, everybody left except for Faye. She's at the counter, alone. It's not right. Go talk to her. So he goes and talks to her, and he tells her he's staying. He's like, what are you going to do? She's like, I'm going to go back home to Erie. Like, that was where my life was. This was the thing that I did. But, hey, look me up next time you're in town. We'll listen to records. We'll hang out. And they say their goodbyes, and she tells him, none of this would have happened without you. She's like, I mean that in a good way, obviously. But, like, you know, this happened because of you. And she's waiting for a cab, and he walks up to her after Lamar kind of gives him some encouragement. And he's like, when was the last time you were, like, good and proper kissed? And she tells him, she's like, New Year's, like, 1959, Gabe Gamelgar, which is a, like, smoldering indictment of Jimmy.
Yeah.
Man, Jimmy sucks even
he
more.
Really, maybe she really did waste 1,000 kisses on him.
Maybe she did.
They were that bad.
Guy leans in and he gives her a big kiss. And he pulls away for a minute to see how she felt about it. And she sits there, and then she comes in and kisses him again. And they
and the movie, finally the together. Theatrical movie ends with them walking back into the hotel. Mm-hmm. Guy is still holding a box. No, he's not holding a box of things anymore.
Yeah, because he asked Lamar to watch his stuff.
Right, but he's heading back in, and he's like, Lamar, do you think you could blah, blah, blah? And Lamar's like, mm-hmm. oh.
That's what I do.
And then he looks down the barrel of the camera.
Yeah, Lamar looks at camera.
Does he say anything?
No, he just smiles.
He doesn't wink. He just smiles.
Nope. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of the movie.
What do you think is the reason? Why is Lamar so central to all of this? He's the key to all of this.
He's the key to all of this.
Lamar is the key to all of this.
I think it's because, like, he has... He's, like, a stand-in for, like, the world experience of L.A., you know? Mm-hmm. The wisdom of all of that. And, like, he's removed from the music industry and the hustle and bustle of it all.
Mm-hmm.
But is, like, on the fringe. I'm not sure.
I think it's odd that, like, about, like, like two-thirds way into the movie... A character is introduced who's like, I'm going to send you to the jazz club. Your girl's in there. And then, like, you're kind of like, yeah, Lamar. You know, he's the valet. He's the doorman, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he's just so essential.
Yeah.
He looks down the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Like he'd been there the whole time.
Totally.
And that's great. I mean, I highly respect Tom Hanks for just being like, yeah, Lamar, just look at the camera. I'm so fascinated by that. I'm sure Lamar has a very extensive history that I'd like to learn.
We all.
Overall, That Thing You Do is delightful. I think it's very fun to watch. I've been trying to figure out what isn't working for me because we've watched it 2 times in the last 3 months.
Yeah,
and both times I've been like Park, this is a 5-star movie for Parker, like.
It is.
Why am, because usually we're pretty, you know.
You're allowed to not like this movie.
No, but
Max.
I'm just saying, I know I am, but I'm just saying that we're usually pretty like connected on things. Like we have pretty similar tastes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to figure out what it is. And I really think it's this odd balance the movie strikes, or rather maybe doesn't quite strike that I want it to, of really naturalistic performances that feel really off kilter in a real genuine way. And especially in the extended cut, there's this scene that they cut out for the final version where they're in the garage rehearsing and Guy goes over for a sandwich and he goes, Faye, is this a bologna sandwich? He's like, never, ever give me a bologna sandwich ever again. And she's like, okay. And then she goes, bologna sandwich. And she like shoves it in his face. And it gives you, it's simultaneously so cute and also so like, stop. Like it feels odd for me. It's like sandpaper for me because it's like so... genuine and realistic, but it's almost uncomfortable for me to watch on film for some reason. I can't figure it out. And Steve Zahn has some deliveries like that,
yeah,
where sometimes he'll say something and I'm like, I get why that's funny and I get why you're like doing this so that I'm like endeared to his character, but I'm also like, it falls between like this like realistic delivery and this like very like forced attempt at like, these are real people, and it's just hard for me. Some of the line deliveries, and I think Tom Everett Scott is the most like this for me, where I am so half and half on him, where some, and like there are so many strong moments from him where I really get the characterization of Guy and I get who he is, and I've met people who are like Guy, and like it absolutely works, and then sometimes I'm just like, what are you doing? Like the way he says Spartacus sometimes, I'm like, that is how a real guy would talk. But it, for some reason, coming from a character, it feels weird. I don't know what it is. I'm like simultaneously like, this is so real. And also I'm like, it feels so unreal to me.
Sure.
I can't nail it down. Something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it bums me out because I think this is a well paced movie. I think there are questions like, why is Lamar the last shot of the, like, I get it. Like, he's just like fun looking at the camera. And there's like certain, I guess maybe not as much after the extended version. There's things that make more sense. But like the Tina subplot is odd in both versions of the movie.
Yeah.
There's just some things that don't work. But overall for me, I'm like, this is a well-made movie. This is a lot of fun. And just for some reason for me, it's like sometimes the line deliveries just kind of, it's hard for me to watch for some reason in some ways. But still an absolutely very fun movie that I think overall really works. And I really enjoy.
Yeah. And it's okay to have whatever feelings you have about it. Because, I mean, like, we've run into that of, you know, you really love David Copperfield. Yeah. And I thought, I was like, oh, it was fun. It was good.
Yeah.
And it was about where I stopped with it. And that's fine.
And
you
that's
know?
Fine.
Yeah.
Great. But do you have any last thoughts about that thing you do?
I don't think so. I mean, I've covered that. I mean, the thing I'll say is just, I think my five stars are so subjective to just that this is a comfort movie for me.
Absolutely.
It's not a great movie, and I know that. But it's one that I love, and it's always going to be five stars for me personally.
Of course. Yeah, and especially those movies that are like family watches, totally. Family favorites. Like, you're always going to be, you know, sweet on that movie that you grew up with and is comforting for you, you know?
Totally. Yeah, exactly. So...
I love that. I love that you love this movie. I think that's fantastic. And I think it was a great pick for your birthday.
Thanks. I think so too. Well, let's do some rapid fire criteria. There's not much of an argument for most of these, and I know that.
I was curious.
No.
If you'd be like, actually,
yeah.
What
so,
Tom Hanks did.
Historical and technical relevance, no. Like song's maybe good. Like the song's good, the song is well remembered. That's about it.
And it has a scene that makes the rounds on Twitter every once in a while.
Sure.
You know?
Yep. So it's a no for me.
But it's a very well liked movie.
Totally.
And that's great.
How well is it doing what it's trying to do? I don't know. I think Tom Hanks set out to make a light, fluffy, no stakes comedy, and I think he succeeds in that personally.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah. I don't think it's doing what it's doing better than Citizen Kane, but I think it's doing what it's doing well.
It's doing what it's doing very, very well. That is true. Yes.
Yep. My point for how well you're connecting with it would go to this. I would much rather watch this any day of the week other than Citizen Kane, but I would be curious to know where you land on that.
I think... That's hard for me, Parker, because... This is a very enjoyable movie, but at the same time, I'm like, I could watch it probably once a year, which is about what I think about Citizen Kane.
Sure.
I don't think it's something that I could put on any day of the week. I couldn't just be like, oh, just dying for some of that thing you do. Mm-hmm. It's watchable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to throw this a bone. I want to be like, this movie is good. So I'll give it to this, knowing that stepping back, I know that I agree with the criterion. But yeah, I could give it to this.
All right.
It's pretty whatever for me either way.
Yeah. We'll give it a 2-1 score. Taking a step back. No, this movie is not better than Citizen Kane. And I know that, but I love it all the same.
But not every movie has to be.
No, it doesn't.
Just a quick reminder to everyone that not every movie has to be better than Citizen Kane.
Precisely.
And that thing you do is exactly, it's doing that thing it tried to do. It does. Yeah, that's better. Parker, you did it better. Fantastic.
Well, there we go, folks.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, don't think that the Parker Rollins fave picks run that we're doing here, the mini run, is over, because it's not. Because next time, Parker... A movie that you haven't revisited in a few years.
I have not.
But that you is in your four favorites.
It is.
Do you want to tell everyone what it is?
Ladies and gentlemen, it is 1988's Cinema Paradiso.
Cinema Paradiso. So I'm really excited. I've only seen this the one time. So I'm really excited to give it another watch.
I'm excited too. Looking forward to it.
Come back next week with a lovely trip to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And cinema.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Great. Well, thanks, everybody. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, everyone.